Can everyone hear me? Hey guys. So, thanks. You know, I'm looking at this audience. You've all been here a million times, so you know that the two functions really of a moderator are to tell you to turn off your cell phones, and we have one upcoming event in a month. Matthew Crabb, Waistlines Change the Nation. This is the co-writer of our Access Asia friend, Paul French. And I really don't think Matthew Crabb exists, so I'm very skeptical if he'll make the appearance, but I think one of the two will be here in a month. Secondly, I will introduce our speaker. I'm not even going to look at any notes. I just want to say two things about her. She's going to talk on investigative journalism, and she has a very august title right now as head of investigative journalism at Bloomberg, whatever. But I would like to remark on two other things. When I started in journalism, I'm now at The Economist, but I used to work under a printing press for the smallest paper in the entire world. And I made a couple $1,000s a year, more than half of which went to rent. And my biggest expense, discretionary expense, every week was to buy the Wall Street Journal. And when I read the Wall Street Journal, my biggest goal was to write like Amanda Bennett. So I've never met her before, but that's how strongly I felt about the copies that I saw. The second thing is that she's the co-author of a book by Sidney Rittenberg, The Man Who Sold the Honey. And I'm guessing that almost everyone in this room has read that book. But if you haven't read that book, to me, that is one of the most illuminating books that I have ever read on China. And I really pride myself in reading anything that has a red cover or the word China on it. I mean, it is really an extraordinary book about an extraordinary man in an extraordinary time. So for me, those two facts, her co-authorship of this really remarkable book and what I know of her as a journalist, make me, you know, I jumped on the chance when I heard she was going to speak here today. Now, I'm sure nothing of what she said will relate to any of those things whatsoever, but anyway, I'm really pleased to be here, so let me introduce Amanda Bennett. Thank
you. What a nice introduction, thank you. First thing I have to say, I was a little bit of a shock and awe here because the last time I stood in this room was during Tiananmen Square, and the place was packed with journalists standing shoulder to shoulder, and the last time before that was actually, unfortunately, 35 years ago, and so I don't even want to go to why that's a scary thought for me. But I will have to say that even though I'm talking about investigative journalism, I think you guys are going to have a lot of questions and thoughts about investigative journalism as it specifically relates to China. And I'm going to say that as soon as you ask me a question about that, I'm going to turn around and ask you about it, because I'm certain that you guys all know way, way, way more about it than I do. But the topic of at the moment is investigative journalism in a global world, and I'd like to read something to you that I think will be very familiar to all of you. And I'm going to read it out of a Bloomberg story that appeared a year ago, written by our now deceased colleague Mark Pittman, who was one of the finest investigative journalists I think that Bloomberg has ever had. And I'll just read you a little paragraph about it, and I think it will speak to investigative journalism and globalization both. One paragraph, it's under a subhead called Financial Dumplings. Sun Quan, a 58-year-old retired parks worker, was among those who bought Lehman mini bonds. He stood outside the IMP Design Hong Kong headquarters of the Bank of China on June 15, along with Yu and 51 other protesters, banging a chip red drum with a stick every 2 seconds. Raindrops beaded on the brim of his blue cap. A sign around his neck, hand-lettered in Chinese characters, read, "The Bank of China is a cheater. Give me back my money, or I'm blood and sweat." Now those guys are still there. You see them every day when you walk around, right? This anecdote wound up in a story of a global series in which we investigated the roots of the Lehman crisis. And the threads of the Lehman crisis took us to that plaza in Hong Kong, to a familiar sight to all of you. It took us to Germany, where the Landesbanks found themselves in the same situation as the folks in Hong Kong, having overinvested in financial instruments they didn't understand, and as a result were having to cut their school budgets. It took us out to the west coast of the United States. It took us to Spain. So all over the world, the threads of the Lehman crisis became the fodder for investigative journalism. Now, in this particular story, we connected a London suicide with the Hong Kong people who invested in London mini bonds, believing that they were actually government-guaranteed bonds, as I think a lot of people around the world actually believed. So in this case, investigative journalism wound up being a matter of connecting dots around the world. And my contention is that increasingly, investigative journalism is going to be globally an issue of connecting dots around the world. And connecting dots around the world from complex financial instruments through companies to individuals so that people can see what the chain of consequences are of financial actions, I think is going to be at the core of what investigative journalism is all about. And that means closer and closer contacts with colleagues around the world. And it, I think, does mean that eventually the very forces that we as traditional journalists have feared and felt threatened by are going to become eventually our allies, and that is the rapidity of electronic communication and the ability for us to spot things happening and make connections and draw on people's experiences around the world, I think is going to become our friend as opposed to our enemy, as I think we've seen it recently. Now, that said, I think your natural question is going to be, we all know what's been happening in journalism around the world. I mean, I've come from the United States, where the last 5 years of journalism has been nothing short of a bloodbath, and so only an organization sort of as big and growing and powerful as Bloomberg News, with offices all around the world, can possibly do this kind of journalism. Well, I have to say that just, you know, since I've been here for 3 days, I've had conversations with people that suggest to me that investigative journalism is really quite alive and well in very, very creative ways. Now, I just saw on the front page of the South China Morning Post a record search that led to the story about the private companies that, you know, have records of development and damage, owning nearly a fifth of all the unprotected parkland. That's, to me, is a perfectly good investigative story. The story about the cadmium levels around the Zijin mines, that strikes me as a perfectly good investigative story that can be used down the road by people like us linking things together. Because where's the product of the Zijin mine going? I mean, there's connecting there. We talked to Chinese reporters when we were in Beijing. We talked about the role of the internet and of local journalists in exposing the melamine milk scandal. And clearly a piece of investigative journalism from the ground up that helped people understand something was incredibly important. What else did we have? There was I guess it was a Wall Street Journal expose of the tracking stuff that was going to be put into the computer, the computers. That was, Greendam. That I think caused that proposal to be rolled back. So these are things done by local Chinese journalists, by local Hong Kong journalists, by international journalists. There certainly seems to be, despite the problems facing journalism, a very lively and active investigative impulse and ability that still exists. I will maintain that given the proliferation of electronic journalism is going to get even stronger. I just forgot what the material was going to be. I think there is I had a story in my head and I forgot it. But let me stop and take a couple of questions while I try and remember what it was I was going to tell you about that was so fascinating. But let me see if we have any questions right now. If you don't ask me some questions, I'm going to turn around and ask you some questions. Here, go ahead.
Thank you. Do you measure, I mean, the sort of examples you're talking about with investigative journalism, they're things that either are or you perceive to be in some way associated with wrongness, with injustice that needs to be corrected. To what extent do you think the role of investigative journalism is actually to bring about change? And to what extent do you think the journalists involved in it see successful change as part of a successful endgame? Or is it just reporting it in and of itself?
Yeah, that's really an excellent question. So there's two, and I remembered what I was going to say. There's two questions embedded in that. One is the exposure of wrongdoing the rightful path for investigative journalists? And then, do you expect change as a result of that, or is it simply the exposure of wrongdoing? And I would say that, yes, I think we all expect that the exposure of wrongdoing is something that is the natural field for investigative journalists, but it is not the only field. And I think that one of the things that we at Bloomberg, because of our global reach, see as the natural provenance of investigative journalism is, as I said, making these connections. So making these connections to show how a complex financial instrument affects a diamond polisher in the outskirts of Delhi, we think is an actual logical thing for a financial journalist to do, because we don't think that the kind of change that we think would be appropriate could happen, can't happen unless we understand what those connections are. And those connections are not always apparent to the people who are in each piece of the chain. So, and do we expect change? I think absolutely. I think we expect some form of change. We hope for some form of change, and we're looking for some form of impact. And that brings me back to what I was talking about, which is the other hat I wear is that of the co-chairman of the Pulitzer Prize Board. And I would like to say that just in the last couple of years, which are probably the most difficult years of journalism, you know, obviously in any of our lifetimes, it has become increasingly clear that investigative journalism, which we had thought of as building up to be a big, expensive, time-consuming, labor-intensive process, is actually returning to its individual roots. And one of the prizes that I was most proud of having helped award was to one reporter at one newspaper in Virginia, which did one set of database investigations. He didn't even know how to do the database work. He talked his editors into sending him to a week-long course to learn how to do the database work. It's a 7,000 circulation paper. There were seven people on the paper. Other people picked up for him while he did stuff. And he basically found how the oil and gas companies were ripping off people and not paying them the royalties that they were allowed to have. So, A, it was one person. Was not an expensive thing. It was time consuming, but everybody managed to make it happen. It was worth doing, and it had an impact in that it got people who were very, very poor access to revenue that they should have had all along. That, to me, is the future of investigative journalism at the other end of the pole. So the big global connection type of work that we're doing, the small individual one person going out and finding something and spending time to get it, and the type of things that I talked to hear about, the cadmium in the Zijin mines, the melamine milk scandal, the food safety issues, these are all things that are accessible to single reporters using the internet, putting in information requests, doing you know, legwork reporting. These are not beyond the scope of a person even with limited resources. So I think that it is incredibly important that it continue to happen, and incredibly possible to continue to happen. Sorry that I had a brain, you know, blip there for a moment, but I also remembered. What other questions do we have here?
Did you want to say, you're traveling all over the world right now working on some new projects that you're doing. Just looking at it from the other end of the spectrum, what a very, very large organization, maybe the most formidable in the world right now, puts into a story. How does it work when you put together one of these global things? How many reporters do you have working on it? What is the formal process? Do they give you all story anecdotes? Do you rewrite it in Washington? Or do they send drafts to one another? How do you run this army?
I might ask Neil to give that answer because he sees it from the ground up, but I'll try. And you know what's really fantastic and fascinating about this is that within Bloomberg you have exactly these two poles. So we have a global organization that draws on people all over the world and tries to build a network of people to get a common view of something that's happening. At the same time, one of the most striking stories that we've had investigated did not come out of our group. It came out of our insurance reporter, who noticed that the insurance companies were taking the life insurance proceeds from deceased Iraq veterans and putting them into a common pool, and instead of paying people the proceeds, were actually keeping the interest and keeping them in their pool, their investment pool, and letting people draw it down as they wanted to, meaning that the companies were profiting on the life insurance proceeds for Iraq veterans. It was one person. An insurance reporter has had massive impact. I mean, there's been hearings all over the United States. Everybody's condemned it. It's going to stop. I mean, ripping off a deceased Iraq veterans by getting the extra percentage points of interest rates on their life insurance proceeds. I mean, how you can understand why that was a big story. One person. Now, our team, on the other hand, has people all over the world. We've got specialists in investigative reporting, people who are writing, and then we work with the indigenous teams, the people that are specialists in finance, specialists in commodities, specialists in bonds, specialists in municipal bonds, and we try and pull together insight from everybody. So as Neil will point out, Neil's got his hands on the reins of all kinds of things, getting a common vision for how things work, how something in one part of the world relates to another part of the world is a complex and time-consuming operation. I'll give you one example. I won't tell you obviously the ones we're working on right now, but I'll give you an example of one we did last year, which I was really, really proud of because it took kind of a flash of insight. But somebody in our Delhi Bureau proposed to do a little feature on suicides in Delhi among the diamond polishers. Now, I don't know if I'm sure you guys all know this, I didn't know it, but something like 85% of the world's diamonds are polished by people sitting cross-legged and, above storefronts, with little bowls of diamonds right outside Delhi or, kind of in the immediate suburbs. And they had committed suicide because their economic livelihood had suddenly gone away. Well, why did their economic livelihood suddenly go away? Because the diamond market suddenly dried up. And why did the diamond market suddenly dry up? And instead of doing this one little story on these diamond polishers, we all of a sudden realized, and I'm talking about these connections, we all of a sudden realized that with the collapse of Lehman, the discretionary spending market for jewelry collapsed all around the world. And we were able to take, our big goal, which we never actually got, was to find the Lehman trader who, the day Lehman collapsed, was on his way to buy a diamond ankle bracelet for his wife and didn't buy it. We had a lead on somebody, but we never got that person. But on the other hand, we did find that the diamond supply collapsed. We got it to a diamond wholesaler calling on Warren Buffett's diamond store in Las Vegas, who was carrying his suitcases of diamonds, walked into the shop and had the guy say, literally overnight, I'm sorry, I'm done, I can't buy anything. So he's standing with his suitcases full of diamonds. That then goes back to the wholesalers in Amsterdam. So we find the wholesalers in Amsterdam who are suddenly not able to make their rent payment. Then we take the wholesalers in Amsterdam back to the polishers in Delhi and the suicides of workers who had themselves been essentially arbitraging their newfound prosperity and overbuying houses by mortgaging themselves against their future revenue. So they wound up with these houses that they couldn't afford based on the idea they were going to be polishing all these diamonds forever, and that collapsed. They wound up not being able to pay their mortgages back to the mines in Botswana, where all of a sudden the guy gets kicked out of work and is thrown out of his rented place and has to go live with a friend. So we're able to take something, the collapse of Lehman, which is because of the overinflation of these financial instruments, and work it through an entire chain of industries back. So we had people on the ground in each of these locations, going out and finding the pieces, and we'd have regular conference calls. It was really very cool. Unfortunately, it did affect, we were talking about this, the sleep deprivation of foreign correspondents, and it certainly did affect our sleep, because in order to get people in Delhi, Hong Kong, Paris, London, in New York, and San Francisco on the phone at the same time, somebody's got to be up in the middle of the night. So we'd have these regular conference calls, find out what we had. You know, we kept trying to find other people and pulling it all together and writing it. It was really a very affecting and terrific story.
What do you do? I mean, if Keith had worked on something like this, it would have run in the New York Times, or if you had done this at the Philadelphia Inquirer, it would have run in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Bloomberg has an electronic Inquirer. It's got Bloomberg Magazine. It's got Bloomberg Business Week. It's got. What do you do after you produce this copy? What do you?
And that's changed quite a bit since the acquisition of Bloomberg Business Week. So there's now even extra things. So we haven't quite figured out this mechanism, but it's sort of like you think of yourself as making this meatloaf. I don't know what it is, but you make this thing, and then you try and figure out how different parts of Bloomberg are going to want it. So in this particular case, it went on the terminal, where it had terrific terminal readership for something that was that long and complex and evocative, and you think you're putting it before essentially traders who have the attention span of a nap. They've got a nanosecond of an attention span. Nonetheless, we got tons of readers for that and lots of feedback on it. So it turned out they do have a kind of a broad interest. Then it goes out onto Bloomberg.com, which means it goes out across the internet, and it takes on an interesting life of its own. Different stories have different pathways. Some of them have fantastic pathways, some of them have more delayed pathways, but they do go out on the web. Sometimes we give them to Bloomberg's Market Magazine, so Bloomberg Market Magazine will run some of them. In this case, the story I read to you about the mini bonds did run in Bloomberg's Market Magazine as well as on the terminal. Now we also have the outlet of Bloomberg Business Week, which takes versions of our stories. We take, cut pieces out of it or shorten it or, do some kind of version of it. BloombergBusinessWeek.com runs things. We have services now, joint venture services with the Washington Post. We have joint venture services with San Francisco. So some of them go out into newspapers. Newspapers pick things up. They run some of them whole. They run some of them part. So it's kind of, and we also do TV and multimedia, which do versions of our story. So our reporters are all going out with handy cams and shooting video that then becomes part of the TV programming.
So who does your reporter work for?
It will depend. I mean, I've got a dedicated staff that works with me.
So they're working all around the world. You have these people working on this diamond story.
Right.
And
but
then it comes to you at some point. Then you edit this piece, which is quite long.
Well, some editor, Neil might edit a piece, or Melissa Posgay in Paris might edit a piece, or somebody in New York or Washington might edit a piece. So we've got editors and reporters in our group. But we also, we've got a very small group in Bloomberg terms. It's, not 30 people. Which in Bloomberg terms is quite small. We draw on all the resources of Bloomberg. So the person that went out to see the diamond polishers in India isn't somebody that works on my team. It's somebody that we said, hey, this is a cool story. It's right, it's right down the road. Go do the reporting for it. So we're drawing on all these things. The control of the process belongs to us. But we are dependent on the kindness of strangers.
And then once you get it, you say to the other editors, I think I have something.
And theoretically, we will have done it long before we get it. It's like, here's what we're doing. I think you'd be interested in some of it. And they say yes, but they mean no. Or they say no, and they mean yes. It's the usual thing with editors.
It's just not the usual thing in the sense that you build a very complicated mechanism of distribution of news. And most of us come from very simple news organizations. There's a newspaper, there's a magazine, we have an editor. It's nothing as sophisticated as what you're describing.
Well, I think it's one of the reasons why we've been having various task force on integration of various products, and I was part of the task force, so I went to Pointer, which you guys probably know about, to see what has been the most successful model for multimedia integration, because the single platforming is obviously something that everyone has tried to do, and essentially they could not come up with any really successful model. It is not an easy thing to do. It is a very complicated thing to do, and the different ways in which things appear. I mean, a newspaper story, a terminal story, a markets magazine story, a business week story are all very different animals, and so it's a complicated, time-consuming process. It's not something where you just say, okay, I've reported this stuff and now it goes out. That works pretty well on just like kind of spot news. You can do it pretty easily when you're just reporting something, and you can then send it out into all the different platforms. But it was something that has a voice and a meaning and a length and a tone. It's quite difficult to do. Yes, ma'am. Over here.
Hi, Amanda. You talk about connecting the dots. Now we have to connect the dots across the border, and that requires a lot of money and time. But on the other hand, the media industry is shrinking globally. So, which means there are only a few companies, a few media companies can afford to invest in investigating reporting. So have you seen actually the quality and the number of investigating reports actually been declining over the years? And the second question is actually a related question, because you were here in China 7 years ago, and now you are back and you've been covering, you know, globally and look at China globalized. And do you see actually the numbers from Beijing are more reliable this day and making your job as an investigative editor easier?
Chris, there's two questions. One is that connecting dots for here in Hong Kong involves connecting into China, which requires, you know, travel and money and staff and all those kinds of things. And so the question was, do we see a deterioration in the quality of the investigative reporting? And the second question is, between now and 30 years ago, do I find numbers more reliable, and does it make the job easier? Okay, so there's a number of questions embedded in that. The first question, I'll just talk overall and not about Hong Kong and China. I would say that sitting on the Pulitzer Prize Board, we receive the best of the best there, that there has been no deterioration in the quality of work. There has been somewhat of a deterioration in the volume of high quality work. So it might be that, you know, we would be torn about 10 different things to be finalists, and you know, there'd be 10 things that would be sort of roughly of the same quality, and now there might be 3 or 4 of the same quality. But the top quality is still the top quality. We haven't seen that. We've seen a lot more creativity in how people are getting these stories. You know, I obviously said I can't speak to the specific issues of covering Hong Kong or China, but what I've seen in the States is a ton more joint venturing with you know, things that used to be rival publications. So, you know, I was the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer for a while, and I look back and see that the Philadelphia Inquirer is partnering with the other newspapers in Pennsylvania that helps them cover Pennsylvania in a way that frees up resources to do investigative reporting at the top end. So the people that they would have had to supply to put on the local Pennsylvania coverage or the Pennsylvania sports coverage, now they can apply those resources to something else. I have no idea the extent to which that's possible here, but joint venturing among news media is clearly something that's about to happen. Bloomberg is doing it as well. You know, in terms of the reliability of the numbers, I think everyone sees that the quality of the numbers that are available are not as reliable as one would hope overall in general. On the other hand, when you compare it to 30 years ago, I mean, there was nothing. So it's like night and day. I found myself constantly in cognitive dissonance up in Beijing because I didn't recognize a single thing. There was nothing I recognized from the fact that there were people that, I mean, 30 years ago, I have a colleague here who can remember that. I lived in a compound with a PLA guard at the door who kept out local Chinese. We have local Chinese working side by side with us in the Beijing office. That's amazing. We have people we can call up to ask information of, and they will answer us. There's people who email us. You know, we can go down to see brokerage firms that have local people working in them who can tell us about the economic condition. You know, it's like night and day. It's like night and day. So the fact that the
the figures are not quite as reliable as we'd like to have them strikes me as, you know, a phase for the next thing. But the fact that there is any kind of, the kind of transparency that there is right now, I mean, I'm just kind of blown away by it. I'll tell you the other thing. I'll give you the clearest example to me of how things have changed in China. I mean, I came here as a non-Mandarin speaker. By the time I left China, I was totally fluent in China. I could do a banquet from beginning to end. And the reason I could do a banquet from beginning to end is there were 15 sentences. That was it. You know, oh, you know how to use chopsticks. Are you used to Chinese food? Do you have children? How long have you been here? I could do the whole thing. I could chat through the entire banquet and everyone would think I was fluent. Go up there now, toast. Cannot, because everyone is willing to talk to you about all kinds of things. So I sit down with the cab driver and I said, do you have children? And he goes, blah, 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 and I'm going like, what the hell did you say? You know, he's talking about the prices of things and should he invest in mini bonds? And, you know, I don't know what he's talking about. I gotta get a whole new vocabulary. People would only talk to you about 15 simple things 30 years ago. And now they'll pretty much talk to you about anything. I mean, I think, right? To me, that's maybe a naive observation, but it certainly struck me. So. Do I believe that all information should be made public? As a matter of policy, I believe that, and I will tell you where Bloomberg put its marker down on this particular thing, which is also was done by this Mark Pittman, who died last year tragically too early, and during the whole bailout process when the Federal Reserve Bank was giving or guaranteeing things to the banks. We realized that we had no idea which banks were getting what, how much they were getting, and what kind of collateral they were putting up. And so he put in a Freedom of Information request to the Federal Reserve Board for that information. And after 4 months passed and they didn't give us any information, we sued the Federal Reserve Board for that information. We have won in court. They've taken us to the appeals court. We've won in that court. They plan on taking us to Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court hears it, I'm confident we're going to win. And I think that our view is that transparency is the best disinfectant, that information should be made public, that there is a very, very, very limited slice of information that can be legitimately argued should not be made public, and that today in the United States, in Europe, in China, in Hong Kong, the vast amount of information is not being made public, far oversteps the things for which legitimate reasons can be made for non-transparency, and that we are putting our efforts behind the not only the principle but the practice of transparency.
Being obliged to tell me the projects you're investigating right now. Therefore, you are obliged to tell me what projects you're investigating right now.
Okay. Sure. I got one on China. I got one on China and Hong Kong. I've got one on France. I've got one on commodities. I've got one on... anyway, I think that was a trick question, guys. What do you think? So.
Yeah, but in the man's defense, there's a legitimate issue there of what should be public economy. You value your trade secrets, and your trade secrets are in fact the stories you have in the process. That's what you were referring to, weren't you? That it's very easy for us up here to say everything should be public until people ask us something that is actually quantitatively of value to us, and then we don't want to share it with what's right.
Yeah, and so, I take your point, and actually that was the argument that the Federal Reserve Board made, which was that the accepting of money from the federal government was a trade secret, and I don't know. I mean, we can argue whether or not that's the right answer. I think there you're asking what is your interest, what is your stake, in what case are you a stakeholder in my information? In the case of the Federal Reserve Board, in the case of military establishment, in the case of economic establishments, our argument is that we are massive stakeholders in that information. I don't believe at the moment that you're a stakeholder in my information. So I guess I walked into your question by saying that all information should be made public. That is obviously an overstatement of the case. No, all information should not be made public. I mean, I don't think I have a right to know what you had for breakfast, for example, or any of your personal information. But in the case in which we are stakeholders in the activities of corporations that pollute the areas in which we live, or in food safety or in governments that are spending our money or increasing our taxes. In that case, I think we are legitimate stakeholders, and I would argue that that goes to things like the whole issues of military policy and things in which the moral force of the nation is at stake.
A quick one. Has access to information improved or down up in the Obama, during the Obama administration? Has access improved, and if so, give us a metric.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting question, because the Obama administration, in his State of the Union address at the very beginning of his administration, promised greater transparency and greater enforcement of freedom of information law and transparency of government agencies, and they have been claiming vast amounts of progress in that. By our measure, it's very hard to get any kind of metrics, but when we look at the types of information, the types of things they are making available, it tends to be very much like some of the information I think that you guys may have had to deal with China and Hong Kong. Huge volume of undifferentiated information that does not actually speak to any of the relevant questions. So there'll be aggregated information or outdated information or things that don't actually speak to the operations of the organization. So our sense is that the commitment to transparency has not yet translated into actual greater transparency, and the time and processing of freedom of information requests, we don't see it has changed, and we keep pretty good track of our own freedom of information act requests. We do use some separate videographers if there's kind of big projects where we feel like we need a bigger and higher quality and more comprehensive. What we're finding, I don't know, Neil, maybe because you've been running people close to the ground, we found that some people are better at than others, and some people are more willing than others, but that some of the things that they're able to get are simply illustrations for things. Neil?
The example I can think of best to give is our Shanghai reporter generally leaves a handicap in the bag until he's finished printing the length that he wants, and then he gets sort of still those thoughts on camera, and he also then takes some scene shots, whatever he wants. But it's a secondary element to get the story.
Do you all
high
definition, or
do
you still use it for
high definition? Not from the technical.
Yeah, that's way past our pay grade. All I can say is when I come back and I look at the things that they've brought back, it's not like a full-fledged day's paid videographer would come back with rolls and rolls, but it's very telling. I mean, you can in a very short amount of time get something that shows you very clearly what you're looking at. I find it's very useful in reporting. When the guy comes back and I say, oh, that's what he means. Oh, by the way, did you notice that he was wearing a red shirt?
Can you tell us whether the hopeful or pessimistic about the future of investigative reporting?
I'll answer that sort of the way people do when they talk about China's economy. I'm a bull in the short term, a bear in the medium term, and a bull in the long term. I think that for a certain cohort of people, and I suspect that many of us in the room fall into that, It's not an easy time for us. People who are, just finishing their career, got the best of the journalistic career, got the best of the economic times, and people who are just starting out now are going to get the best of the new world. There's a transitional period that we're going through right now where it's very, very difficult, where the economic models are in flux, the reporting models are in flux, the idea of how we use or don't use, compete or cooperate with these economic models are in flux. It's very, very difficult. I think that this is all going to be figured out. And I think that, you know, journalism schools in the United States have record enrollments. They're turning people away. I think that the future of investigative journalism is going to be extraordinary. I think it's going to be absolutely extraordinary, but it's going to belong to the next generation.
Thanks. What do you see as the role of an organization like WikiLeaks in the future of investigative journalism that you just mentioned?
Gosh, you know, that is a question I would like to turn back on you guys. I absolutely don't know. I mean, I'd love to hear a debate on that. I'm afraid that one's out of my range. I just can't tell you. What do you think?
You know, you might want to identify yourself too when you ask questions.
Yeah.
Like, go ahead and do you want to respond to that?
If you give WikiLeaks a blitzer.
Yeah. Or jail.
Yeah, well, I wonder what the broader impact of organizations that aren't part of the mainstream media and don't have...
Sky, why don't you say who you are?
Yeah, my name is Sky Knevis, formerly a reporter with the Wall Street Journal and now at HKU.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm also trying to figure this out in my research and what the implications are of the non-mainstream media, the WikiLeaks, the bloggers, that definitely are having an impact on investigative journalism and how it's practiced.
You know, I think that one of the things that's very interesting is when you think about the mainstream media in its current, or let's say 5 years ago, consolidated mode, is actually a very recent phenomenon. I mean, I worked for a paper in Lexington, Kentucky. It was called the Lexington Herald Leader. And it was the combination of two papers, the Herald and the Leader. So a place the size of Lexington had two papers and had probably a handful of others. I mean, there was no such thing as the mainstream media. These ideas, these big media conglomerates, the chains, the large-scale papers with big budgets, that's a fairly recent phenomenon. And we think about even going back to sort of the beginning of what we romantically think about the Jeffersonian era of free speech and proliferation of news and information. The reason that era existed was that the price of paper dropped enough that people could themselves afford to distribute their own papers saying what they wanted and exposing people what they wanted and saying what they wanted. I think that is very much the equivalent of the internet. So I think that the proliferation of these non-mainstream media organizations is actually very good, and that what we will begin to discover is branding and trusting, and so people will begin to develop reputations as either, you know, bomb throwers or respected researchers or investigators. So there will begin to become a familiarity with who these things are and what it is that they do, so that we as consumers of these media will begin to understand what we can trust and what we can't trust. But in the meantime, I think that the full flowering of you know, opening out of all these different avenues for people to report and put out what they want, including their own opinions, I think is fantastic. I hope you think it's fantastic.
Do you think it's fantastic? All right, we probably have time for one more question.
And there was one right there.
Now, my name is Lu Ming Ho. I am retired IT professional. I have a question about, I'm not even sure if it's part of investigative reporting. You know, these people who pose as somebody, like recently, you know, ex-princess in England, Fergie, met with this somebody who posed as a sheik and tried to make a business deal to meet with the current prince of England. Are these things a part of investigative reporting? You know, make news happen?
You know, during my lifetime, my professional lifetime, which began at the Wall Street Journal, and I'm sure during yours, that was considered a legitimate part of reporting. I mean, I can remember Chicago Tribune reporter who won a Pulitzer Prize for posing as a hospital orderly and going in and helping doctors perform operations. You know, the underground reporting, the Wall Street Journal had that young woman who went in to Hewlett-Packard and posed as a worker to find out about how they crushed unionizing activity. So during my professional lifetime, posing and deception were considered a legitimate part. Now, right now, I think nothing could be further than the case. Posing and deception is absolutely anathema to mainstream media. I think it would be anathema to all of us. The idea that we would pretend to be anybody who we weren't, that we would use any kind of deception, that we would do anything other than identify ourselves. Certainly, whenever there's any kind of issues, one of our first questions to our reporters is, did you identify yourself? And the only correct answer is yes. So there is a changing view of what is right and what is proper, and I think that's going to be part of the differentiation between different kinds of news organizations, is us understanding what kind of news organizations we are, and if there are news organizations that return to these previous ideas that, you know, you get news by through deception and by pretending, then you'll know that those are different kinds of organizations and how you're going to evaluate the news you get from them.
We have a desperate question.
Yeah, I'd love to engage with this because I did a very well-known piece of journalism in the States where I posed as an illegal immigrant in Los Angeles and wrote a 16-part series called Sweatshop, mm-hmm. Undercover in the Garment Industry. And this argument was made by some people on the Pulitzer board that year who felt that it was deceptive. Yet the entire jury, or the board, not the jury, of the Pulitzer made the counter argument, which I think still holds, that there are certain ways, there are certain times when the only way that you can get information is by posing as someone that you're not. That was number one. And also, when you say that that's not going on, I think that you forget about restaurant critics, for example. They go to restaurants all the time and they don't reveal themselves. And I don't think there would be another way to get a true or an accurate picture of the food in that restaurant. And it seems to me that with, and this is a question I don't know the answer to, but it seems to me that there's so much contention around every bit of information, however it's gotten, that it has pushed legitimate undercover reporting into a kind of widespread disrepute, whereas it does play and has played from the earliest days. There was Nellie Bly, who was Joseph Pulitzer's reporter and went undercover to investigate conditions on Ellis Island.
And so what's the question?
I'm asking you whether you think that, given this context, that there is indeed a legitimate role for undercover reporting rather than calling it, you know, deception. And,
you know, I think I'm going to punt on this question right now by saying that there is so much work to be done in legitimate above board reporting that we haven't even come close to touching, that to get caught up in a debate about deception right now is kind of moving over to the side. I don't even think we've fully exercised or fully used our straightforward front door ways of operating in very effective ways. So I'm not sure that right now that that's a particularly useful discussion to get caught up in.
You know, it's 2:00, so we generally end now. Our format here is sort of rigid. We have a speaker, they give a speech, we take a couple minutes of questions at the end. I think if you ever, you know, choose to come here again, and it would be great if you did, maybe we should organize some sort of discussion that allows people to go back and forth. I mean, some of the questions that are coming up here are yours, Sky's, and so forth, just beg for a discussion between people here.
I think it would be fantastic.
So,
I think it would be fantastic.
I've been speaking for the professional affairs, for Keith, for the board, and everyone here. We'd love you to come back. We'd love to schedule some sort of different structure around how you would talk. And meanwhile, I'd just like to really thank all the people who asked questions and sat here, and I'd like to, you know, we always have a gift to give you at the end of, you know, some sweatshop labor thing from the grocery department. Anyway, we would like to, and you need to have your photo taken. But anyway, thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, really. Very interesting questions.